Halloween, and welcome to the best in true crime talk radio. It's True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Tim Dennis will join me a little later for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. We've got a good one for you tonight, folks. I've been promising for Halloween we're going to bring you a very unique story, and that we have. Mary Jane's Ghost, the Legacy of a Murder in Small Town America. We'll talk about that in a second. Let me remind you, we are still doing our Halloween for Hunger campaign, and we need your help. We're helping to raise money for Second Harvest Heartland. We've included the link right here on this episode information guide. So if you can click on that, that'll be the easiest way to find it. You can make the donation in any size, $1, $5, $10, $20, a million, whatever you've got to give. Every dollar we raise goes right back into our communities here in the United States to help feed our neighbors, friends, lovers, coworkers, all the people right in our own communities that need our help the most. Second Harvest Heartland is so proficient at what they do. Every $1 that we get helps supply 3 square meals for a person in need. You heard that right. 3 full meals for a person in need. All we need is you. Your heart, your compassion. Consider this the knock on your door for trick-or-treating, for helping to end hunger here in the United States. Do what you can, and please click that link or go to darknessradio.com and click on the Halloween for Hunger banner. If for some reason you still cannot find it, then just go to dave@darknessradio.com, email me, and I'll send you that link. Our goal is lofty this year, $15,000. That's what we're hoping to reach. But between Coast to Coast, The Tom Bernard Show, True Crime Tuesday, and Beyond the Darkness, there's no reason we can't hit that by this coming Saturday. So please open your hearts, open your wallets, and make that donation to help us out right now. Let's begin on tonight's journey. This is a cool story, very fascinating, and it was brought to my attention recently by a few of our listeners. It was the summer of 1948. In a scenic remote river town of Oregon, Illinois, when a young couple visiting the local Lover's Lane is murdered. This sounds like it's been ripped straight out of urban legend territory, folks. I'm just waiting for the bloody hook to be hanging on the door at the end of the story. That's what brought me in on this book. Let's talk to our guest this evening. Ted Gregory is joining us to share this very twisted, very unusual tale. Ted Gregory is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter at the Chicago Tribune and co-author of 2 books, To Chase a Dream and Our Black Year. He lives near Chicago, Illinois. Ted, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's great to be here, Dave. Thanks for having me.
What a great story to bring to us for Halloween, Ted. Thank you for agreeing to do this.
Sure. Yeah, it's complete with ghosts and everything.
Exactly. So I've got to ask you about this. Now, before we get too much into this, because our normal show is a paranormal-themed show, I would like to talk a little bit about your experiences and thoughts on this. I mean, when this was coming to your attention and ghosts were involved, did that just make you automatically want to roll your eyes, or were you fascinated by it because of the paranormal angle?
Yeah, you know, it was a little bit of both. When this came to me, it was basically a letter that came, that sort of was an open letter sent to the Chicago Tribune, and just dropped on my desk. And I came to work one day, and there it was. And so I started to look into it. And the fellow at the center of this case, Mike Arians, is kind of an eccentric guy, but clearly not a nut at all. But when he started to talk about ghosts, you know, I had sort of 3 distinct responses. One is, you know, this person is nuts.
Right.
You know, the second is, this is BS and this person is trying to play me. And the third was, I'm scared out of my mind. So
those are good positions to hold on here. Questioning and what if this is very real? Have you ever had anything that you would consider in your life paranormal happened to you, Ted?
Well, I don't think so, except that when I did go up to Mike Arians' town, I went to Oregon and visited him. He gave me a tour of his roadhouse. He owns an old roadhouse kind of on the outskirts of town. It's a really cool place. And while we were taking a tour of, this was in the middle of the day, but it was cold and dark and the place was closed. And, he was walking me around and, pointed up to the balcony and sort of paused a moment. And on the balcony, was a mannequin, dressed like the victim, one of the victims, Mary Jane Reed. He paused, and when he looked up there, and he just said, you know, she's really was a beautiful woman. And I didn't really know what was going on, and I looked up and I saw this mannequin. And Dave, I did get a definite chill that just went right up my spine and kind of settled somewhere around my ear canal. And so I felt something was there, and that probably was the closest thing that I've experienced along those lines.
All right, we're going to dig into this story, folks. We've got our guest for the entire show. I want to mention that on our regular show, Beyond the Darkness, this month we featured True Crime Tuesday Stories Revisited. And tonight we brought you a doozy. So not only do you get this great story, brand new, only for you True Crime Tuesday subscribers, but if you go check out Beyond the Darkness, you'll be able to hear another very compelling story. It is The Devil and the Werewolf, a killer love story. It's our special Halloween edition of Beyond the Darkness True Crime Tuesday Revisited. We were joined by Calgary Herald journalist Sherry Zikafoos, who detailed a very bizarre murder perpetrated by a 12-year-old girl who at the time was Canada's youngest serial killer, and her 23-year-old boyfriend, who believed he was a 300-year-old werewolf. Oh, it's weird, it's twisted, but make sure you go check that episode out for yourself. Right now it's at Beyond the Darkness. You can find it at darknessradio.com, or you can go subscribe to it at podcast1.com and then look up Beyond the Darkness so you never miss another minute of the best in paranormal talk radio. Let's dig deep now and get into this case. Talk to me about the summer of 1948. What was it like in Oregon, Illinois?
Yeah, you know, it's such a different time than it is now, Dave. You know, now we're all interconnected and everybody can Skype and see everything that everybody's doing and call cell phones and all this stuff. But back then, you know, Oregon was a pretty remote place. Now, it's about 100 miles directly west of Chicago. And it has a bit of its own kind of unique history. There was an artist colony there that started spun off of the World's Fair of 1893. There's local lore has it that Jesse and Frank James raced horses at the county fair before they came up to Minnesota and pulled off their big Northfield Minnesota race. Even Abraham Lincoln and Jefferson Davis fought on the same side in the Black Hawk War. But there is also something of a spiritual or a paranormal history that's there as well. And one of the reasons that some folks think these sort of spirits are hanging around is that along the Rock River there, it's a very scenic area, a lot of bluffs and rock formations. Along the that stretch of the Rock River, there are about 30 Native American burial mounds, and so there's that sort of vibe is there. But in 1948, Oregon was it was a town of about 3,000. There was some commerce there, the piano factory that did quite a bit of business, but it also was kind of a place where lots of folks came to escape. And a place that, by its remoteness, sort of could make up its own rules, and that is sort of at the heart of what some folks say was the reason this case was unsolved.
The town that this was, I mean, was it the quintessential white bread American wholesome town? Was it factory working town? Was there, you know, a lot of drunken revelry at night? What can you tell us about the whole feeling of that area at that time?
Yeah, I would say that it's always been a conservative town, and I think on the surface it was a very straight-laced town. Now there's also some quite a bit of evidence though that there was a sort of a wild element there. Lots of folks could definitely like to have a good time. I mean, there was quite a few taverns in town, and there was there's always been some talk that organized crime guys would like to come out to Oregon to relax and enjoy themselves a little bit more outside of the eye of the law. So I would say that in many ways it was very similar to a sort of a classic Americana town of 1948. And you know, I'm a person who believes that Illinois is sort of the classic microcosm of the U.S. and really sort of a microcosm of the Midwest. So Oregon was right in that kind of a realm.
Were there a lot of crimes in that area, violent crimes at all, or was this kind of a standalone event that took place?
Well, this was a big deal. I mean, you know, it was a murder on Lover's Lane, as we talked about earlier. It was 17-year-old Mary Jane Reed and her date, 28-year-old Navy veteran Stanley Scridla, who lived in a town about 35 miles away, Rockford. It was a big city, big industrial city. And when it occurred, part of the reason that it was so sensational was that they were on this Lover's Lane, doing what folks do on a Lover's Lane late on a June night, and someone approaches the car, or maybe several people approach the car. They either pull Stanley out of the car, or he gets out of the car himself and confronts them. He's shot several times. His body is dragged to the side of the road, and then they grab Mary Jane. And Mary Jane disappears. There's a huge manhunt. It draws attention from Chicago and from many other cities. It gets nationwide attention. I mean, newspapers from Maine to California were covering this thing. And Mary Jane's, the days pass, 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. She's still not found. Finally, the fourth day, the morning of the fourth day, she's found by a truck driver about a couple of miles north of where Stanley's body was found. And it was in a weedy ditch sort of on the side of the road. But part of the mystery and the suspicion and the unanswered questions revolve around this four-day gap where Mary Jane was missing and what happened during those 4 days and why was she taken and that kind of thing. And so it was quite a scandalous thing, and what wound up happening was, of course, there was a great deal of attention on Little Oregon, Illinois, for a number of days and weeks. But as time passed, the case just sort of faded away a little bit. They never arrested anyone, and it just kind of faded off into time's indifference. Is one of the ways I phrase it.
Did they have anybody, any suspects at the time that they thought made sense?
Well, they, you know, in reading newspaper accounts of the time, Dave, they had just a whole slew of possibilities. They were investigating a Navy friend. They were talking to a person who was who would regularly park by himself, an elderly gentleman who would regularly park by himself at the Lover's Lane, and who knows what that was all about. But they were questioning numerous people and never wound up charging anyone, never even really had someone that they felt was a, you know, quote-unquote person of interest. I mean, they never even got it down to that. But I will say that part of what may have been happening here, and it's part of sort of a scandalous theory, was that there might have been some law enforcement involvement at the front end. In other words, There are some people who believe that law enforcement was involved or responsible for the murders.
Interesting. Now, Ted, were there other, I'm sure in researching this, did you cross-reference to see if other murders, Lover's Lane murders, things like that had happened anywhere near there or within the state of Illinois as well?
Yes. Yeah, I looked around, and actually, you know, at the time there was quite a bit of coverage, and I didn't find anything. like that.
Now, when we think of that, most people think of like the Zodiac Killer and the violence and what took place in that situation. But this, as I said, this sounds like it's straight out of the urban legend dictionary, right? The Lover's Lane murders, the things that took place. Now, had they been a couple long? Was this a new burgeoning relationship? What can you tell us about them?
Well, it's a little unclear. We do know, it appears to be there. I should say they worked together. So Mary Jane Reed, as I said, was a 17-year-old girl who lived there in Oregon. She was a telephone operator in town. And Stanley was a telephone lineman for the company. And they supposedly met, on the job. And near as we can tell, this was their first date. Stanley was playing cards in Rockford, at the sort of a bigger industrial city about 40 miles or so north of Oregon. And he left there about 8 o'clock and was to drive down to Oregon and have a date with Mary Jane. They were seen at a number of different establishments, including Mike Arian's Roadhouse. As a matter of fact, there's some belief that the Roadhouse was the last place they visited before they went to Lover's Lane. And that was sort of the last that most people that I could tell, research showed that was kind of the last anybody knew of them. So seems like this was their first date, but they did know each other from work.
Was there any scandalous nature in either one of their lives? Her being portrayed perhaps as a loose woman who would find herself in situations compromising or not with men that she didn't know. Was he a drunkard or a lout or a problem child, kicked out of the military? Was there anything like that that fit anything that would maybe start to look like red flags in this case?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Dave. And the situation was, as far as Mary Jane, she was what I would refer to as a complicated person. She taught Sunday school, and yet she was a young lady who had what we might call an active dating life. And so there was that background where it was a little bit more complicated than what it appears.
And before before I start getting the hate mail, folks, I'm not trying to paint the picture of a woman who got what she deserved. I'm just trying to understand if this was simply totally unbridled passion that happened one night, or was this maybe a woman who put herself into some dangerous situations from time to time? As we get to know some of these stories, sometimes on the front end they look very innocuous and innocent. And then as you start to de-evolve even the killers and the victims in these stories, you start to find out very weird, interesting backstories that may show that there were plenty of people that could have been involved in the murder. And that's why I'm bringing that out. I hate that we're at that point in history where I have to proclaim this, but I wanted to at least be clear up front that I'm not trying to make her seem she was looking for this issue.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. And I don't mean to imply that either.
Right.
There's lots of folks who have active social lives, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they're doing something unsafe. And it's certainly nothing that Mary Jane did. With the word I'm looking for, she didn't deserve this. Like
exactly.
You referred to earlier, there's nothing like that at all. In Stanley's case, so Stanley was a Navy vet, and he served a couple of years in the Navy, actually saw a lot of the world, and was discharged honorably. But some of the indications about Stanley's background was that he it appears as if he would he organized several card games throughout that region. I'm talking about gambling card games like poker or whatever. So he sort of ran in those circles. One of the theories on the crime is that, he hooked up with Mary Jane. They had planned their date, and they were driving around these different places, and he was kind of acting like a big shot, flashing money and this and that. And he might have offended people. He was a guy who was, you know, quote unquote from out of town, and here he was with this, you know, one of their local girls, and you know, that kind of stuff can sort of spin out of control a little bit if somebody starts to act a little arrogant or you know, starts popping off. So that's the general backstory of who they were. You know, maybe not the most upstanding citizens, but very human, I think, and not people who engage in really reckless behavior or really, you know, substantially illegal behavior. So there was nothing in their background that would strike me as being, again, sort of a reckless personality who may have found themselves in a situation where most normal folks wouldn't.
Well, that explains why there wasn't a preponderance of possible criminals involved in this, right? I mean, there wasn't a long list for them to start going through as culprits or, you know. Now, with that in mind, in a lot of these stories, Ted, it seems like there was a drifter that was noticed that night or around the town at that time. Do we have any kind of, you know, loner stories that fit that?
Right. Yeah, there was a little bit of that. In early newspaper accounts, there was somebody, I think, who was, you know, riding the railroads and this and that. But it felt to me when I was reading through the stuff that it was almost like they were looking for someone or something to pin this on, or just an excuse to cloud the investigation. Now, I'll tell you that, you know, when I got the letter from Mike Arians way back, now this was all the way back in 2003.
Well, hold on. Before we get to that point, you've got this kind of case. I want to hear about what happened with that reinvigorates this story and case. And there's quite a gap between this horrible crime taking place and it just fading into obscurity and then kind of regaining strength and notoriety. But after that, how you said it was kind of an intense moment there in Oregon, Illinois. How long did that entire original investigation and, you know, I guess investigation go for at that point?
From back in 1948, the original one?
Right.
That was several weeks and several weeks to a couple of months. And, you know, it just sort of faded away. You know, it would be investigated again. You know, a new sheriff would be elected and he would make some noise about reinvestigating it. And from time to time they would mount an investigation, but you know, boy, they wouldn't really get any traction on it. And so it would fade away for another 10 or 15 years or somebody else a new sheriff would be elected and they would investigate it and then it would sort of go away. And the reason it kind of got revived 50 years later, which is was one of the reasons that it was so appealing to me, was that Mike Arians moved to town moved to Oregon in the mid 1990s, and in 1998, a local reporter did a long piece on the 50-year anniversary of the crime and how it had been unsolved. Mike Arians read that right about the same time he was running for mayor of Oregon, Illinois. Got elected mayor, and this case really sort of stayed with him. I mean, he told me that it just resonated with him so deeply, he couldn't really shake it. And once he got elected mayor, some folks would sort of came to him anonymously and not so anonymously, telling him, "Boy, you know, you really should look into this and take a look at it. There's much more here than meets the eye." And so Mike did, and he invested quite a bit of money and quite a bit of his own time in it, and he suffered a lot of consequences for it. But what he came up with was a pretty scandalous theory that essentially said that a local law enforcement officer was having an affair with Mary Jane. She broke it off, and he was pretty upset about that. and that he was responsible for her death.
Okay. Really? No, that's kind of out of left field.
Right. Well, it was sort of initially, as I sort of investigated the case, there certainly were some things that made one think that possibility existed. There was a real lack of cooperation among the locals in town, particularly women, in the investigation. And there were reports that this local law enforcement officer and Mary Jane had a relationship. There were people who did see them together. And the fact that the local investigators didn't resolve it, and that there was this relationship, and there wasn't a lot of cooperation, especially from women back in the day, made Mike feel that one of the reasons there wasn't a lot of cooperation was that folks were fearful that if they said anything, they might be next, or there might be something, some consequences for them to pay. So that was his theory that he sort of worked through over the years. He, like I said, he invested, I think, upwards of $100,000. He spent hundreds and hundreds of hours of his own time. He lost his mayoral reelection largely because of his involvement. His business really went south in a big way. He had to close it for a while. There's a lot of stuff was kind of swirling around this thing once he reopened the Pandora's box. And then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, so we sort of referred to it earlier, he believed that Mary Jane's ghost inhabited his roadhouse.
Is that why he became so obsessed with this story? I mean, this seems like more than obsession. This is a dark obsession that propelled him to spend so much time, money, and effort that cost him nearly everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing, I talk with Mike a lot about that. And there's a part of me that believes he doesn't fully understand, what drove him to do this. But I mean, he does, in this sort of more honest moments. I mean, he's always been very honest and open in talking to me about the case and answering any question I had. But it does make me feel like, and he does sort of convey that he has a sort of a relationship with Mary Jane's spirit, Mary Jane's ghost.
Hold on one second. You just cover that so nonchalantly and matter-of-factly there, Ted. As a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, we need to dig a little deeper here, my friend. What do you mean he felt that he had a kind of relationship with her? Was she visiting him? Was he physically seeing her? How did this connection begin?
Well, it's a great question. So it began by when he took over the roadhouse. It is an old building, but he said, there was a lot of noise and creaking and plates falling and this kind of thing that was quite a bit more than he would have anticipated even in an older place. After a while, when he reopened, these sorts of things continued. They started joking around that it was the ghost of Esther Stenhouse. Esther Stenhouse was one of the original proprietors who passed away in a bathtub up the stairs on the second floor of a heart attack in the 1940s, I think, or the 1950s. So they were joking around whenever these noises or odd things would happen, it was Esther. But they sort of continued. you know, a waitress quit because she was too creeped out in the place late at night. One of the best stories that Mike tells is that he had a jukebox in the place, and it would sort of spontaneously kick in to this song called "After Sunrise," which is a song by Sergio Mendes in Brazil '77. It's kind of a haunting song with a sort of a heavy guitar playing and a woman's voice through it. This would just sort of play, like I said, spontaneously. No one would put money in the jukebox or anything like that. And so he just sort of started to feel like, well, wait a minute, this is something a little bit bigger than that. And then he started to notice that the name Mary Jane kept coming up. I remember when he told me he got an official form from the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency on his storm management. It was signed by Mary Reed. He got a fax from an equipment manufacturer, and the woman's name who transmitted it was Mary Jane. While he was away from the roadhouse, a delivery man shows up with flowers on November 15th, which is Mary Jane's birthday, and he was turned away. Mike wasn't at the roadhouse, but this fellow shows up on November 15th, Mary Jane's birthday, and was turned away, and Mike never did find out who sent them. So he says that it was getting to the point where he and his wife and the help at the roadhouse were experiencing these, what he calls, incidents, you know, and they were so abundant, he said, that we just kind of started to accept in almost a jovial way that it wasn't Esther, but it was Mary Jane. So these things, like I said, they kept going and kept going. And he eventually did contact psychics over time. One woman named Ruth, the psychic visited his, one psychic visited his roadhouse in around 2002, and she identified one of the spirits being named Ruth. Well, Ruth is the first name of Mary Jane's mother, but the psychic was having sort of trouble going deeper. So, over the years he had other psychics through there, and they've kind of given him slightly different stories, but most of them have all said that there's something going on at the roadhouse.
Now, you're looking up this information. You're reading this letter that he sent to you. All right, fascinating. It's an unsolved murder that somebody is this interested in it 50 years later. That's all intriguing. Now, again, as I mentioned, you're a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. It starts going into the realm of the supernatural. In all honesty, what made you decide to follow this story instead of just kind of, you know, filing it away in the round file cabinet next to your desk?
There was a number of factors. I mean, I think first of all, it was just the basic facts of the case. You know, the notion that this pretty shocking double murder happens on a lover's lane in 1948 in small town America. And again, you know, as I said earlier, got the headlines coast to coast, couldn't be solved. You know, I just thought, I found that alone was just intriguing to me. And Mike's personal story was very intriguing to me too. You know, I was trying to figure out, well, what was it about this case that is possessing this guy to sort of, you know, throw away make so many sacrifices to keep pursuing this thing. And I was very intrigued, essentially, you know, to try to keep an eye on how he was handling it, you know, how he was managing his demons in a way. And there's something about Oregon too. Oregon is a beautiful place. I think I mentioned earlier, you know, it's surrounded by 5,000 acres of State Forest. It's got a certain draw to it, artistic, creative. It's got a quirky history. And then there was Warren Reed. Warren Reed is the lone surviving sibling of Mary Jane. Mary Jane was one of six kids, I think it was. And Warren was 6 years old when his oldest sister, Mary Jane, was murdered. And, his story and sort of how he was dealing with both her death and then Mike's investigation of it also drew me to it. It's funny because in some ways I look at Mike's following of this case as an obsession, but I'm always telling myself, well, I wasn't obsessed by it. No, of course, but I could never get my mind off of it. I was sort of always thinking about it. And I think it was just a number of factors that just kept swirling around and made me keep checking back in every few months to see how it was going.
That aspect didn't scare you away from the story? Did you think you were just going to leave that part of it out and just go for the straight on true crime angle of this tale?
It's funny. It's a good question. I was, as I told you, the three responses that I have to someone who would tell me about supernatural occurrences. And I decided that what I needed to do was just sort of go with it. I needed to sort of confront whatever fears I may have. And I had some fears. I'll be honest with you. I was fearful of it, but I thought, well, this also is an opportunity to learn, right? It's an opportunity to sort of grow and explore this thing. I'm a newspaper reporter. That's what we do. We investigate things. We try to get to the bottom of them. And that actually, I feel, is a healthy experience. So I went to a seance at the Roadhouse a couple of days. Actually, it was probably almost exactly this date, or a couple of days, I should say, right before Halloween. And I confronted my fears and my doubts and my skepticism. That's a chapter in the book. I won't go into a whole lot of detail about that right now because we want folks to read the book. But I will say that I went in scared, and I felt like it would be a valuable experience for me to sort of confront those fears. And that's what I did. And I live to tell the story, Dave. I live to tell the story.
Did it give you a new perspective? I mean, as somebody who is skeptical yet, and I get that, whether you believe in the supernatural or not, your mind can play games on you. And we've seen enough in Hollywood films and TV shows to unnerve you that no matter how stoic and strong you think you are, you put somebody in that position and it can really start to shake their paradigm. When you went into that and when you came out of it, would you say that you're a different man in your beliefs and understandings of things? Or are you just, is your curiosity more piqued?
I would say that I'm different. It changed my viewpoint. I think I'm more open-minded to the paranormal and to, quote unquote, ghosts and presence in places. From my perspective, I don't think it's all that different. There's a lot of folks who believe in angels, and I don't know that there's necessarily it's a big leap of faith to jump from an angel to a ghost or a spirit. And I also think, I've thought a lot about, when a person passes away, or even your pet passes away, or anything, what happens to that life energy? That energy goes. It goes somewhere, right? And where does it go? I know I'm getting pretty physical here. I'm getting a little bit.
You're talking to the right guy for this, Ted. It's fine. Go for it.
but. That question, where does that life energy go, to me opens the door to the possibilities of you know, paranormal presences. Let's just say that. And I think that I don't fear that stuff like I used to fear that stuff after this experience.
You go to this seance. This is part of research for the book. I'm just curious on a personal level. Are you telling people what you're doing in order to research this book? And how are they? Are they supportive of this? Are they laughing at you? What was that like?
You mean that I tell people that I'm going to a seance and that, you know, I'm trying to figure out if I believe in ghosts and all that?
Right.
Dave, I might not have shared that information as broadly as I probably would now.
Okay.
Maybe that's something that I should explore why I didn't. I mean, while I was working on the book, and I would tell people here and there about different aspects of it, and whenever I would bring up, you know, suggestion of, again, sort of the paranormal or supernatural or ghosts, most people would roll their eyes at me and think I was crazy. And I would kind of shake my head and laugh about it because I was still, you know, kind of trying to sort all this out and figure it out on my own. My wife was a deeply spiritual person, and a person of deep faith, and it may sound somewhat contradictory, but she is a person who also has a very open mind about, you know, spirits and that kind of thing. So I could talk to her about it, and she was actually, sort of very reassuring, for me, about it. She was, she would, make me try to sort through whatever fears and hesitancy I may have over them, and kind of filter that out, you know, or unpack that, I should say, and that was helpful. So while I wasn't all that forthcoming with a lot of people, I would sort of mention it lightly or in passing. I would get generally critical or, you know, joking kind of a response, and so I would just sort of shrug that off, and then other conversations with some other folks, mostly my wife, helped me kind of, again, not be so fearful of it and just sort of go into it open-mindedly.
These visitations that he was getting, this feeling of spirituality and that there was some tie to Mary Jane, did this continue throughout his entire investigative process? Did he ever come to a conclusion whether there was spiritual connection to Mary Jane, or is that still an open-ended question for him and his family?
No, I mean, he very much believes that that, you know, her spirit is there, It sort of comes and goes. He tells me, and I'm still in touch with him today. You know, I just exchanged a couple texts with him yesterday. He's convinced that that her presence inhabits the Roadhouse, and that it becomes more active at certain times and less active at others. I'm trying to remember. I think he says, you know, whenever there's some publicity or an investigation or somebody talks about an investigation, the presence becomes more active, he says. And then sometimes it'll just kind of taper off, and he won't get any signs or vibes from that presence for a number of weeks.
In his opinion, has he cracked this case? Does he know who the killer or killers are?
Yes.
And as somebody who has to remain objective as a researcher and reporter, do you ever get the feeling that you're going down a rabbit hole in this kind of story, or do you see a clear defining line of logic that takes you to the potential suspects or the real criminals behind this?
Yeah, you know, Mike has a very definite belief and on who committed this crime, and he believes that law enforcement was responsible for it. And in my investigation, and you know, I don't want to give away the end or my conclusion on it. It's a little bit more difficult for me because in my line of work, I have to get, you know, what would be considered sort of concrete proof. Sort of documents are very helpful. Interviewing people who were around at that time, sort of the hard facts that you would generally think of being used in a courtroom or in a police investigation. So it's a slightly different approach, it's not necessarily the same burden of proof, and I think that certainly Mike has a very sort of personal interest in this. I think that he feels certainly a kind of a moral obligation to do right by Warren Reed and sort of, I don't want to say avenge, but hold someone accountable for the death of this young woman and her date. Although, Mike's connection clearly is with Mary Jane. So we have had our differences and our discussions, quote unquote, okay. Mike and I, but like I said earlier, Mike has always been very open and very respectful of what I'm doing and how I'm doing it. And even though, as I did several stories for the Chicago Tribune on this case over the years, I followed the case for 13, 14 years in writing this book. And throughout that time, some of the stuff that I reported on about Mike was not very flattering. There were people who were saying that he was essentially trying to get rich, that he was exploiting Warren Reed, that he was crazy. There were a lot of folks who were, again, kind of pretty cruel to Mike. And in my pursuit of the story, I was talking to a wide spectrum of people and trying to get all sides in there. And no matter what I wrote, Mike was always willing to come back and talk with me and share whatever he had. I respect him for that. I respect him a lot for that.
There is no limitations or statute of limitations on murder. If there is this right. much information, has it been brought to the attention of the Oregon, Illinois Police Department? I mean, obviously, it's not like you're writing for, a small online tabloid. You work for the Chicago Tribune. Has this kicked over enough stones right. that they're willing to reexamine this case and perhaps put a final closing statement together for it or to reexamine, the people involved?
Well, it's funny you mention that because in 2005, 2006, Mike was agitating so much, and he was getting a lot of the media coverage, both sort of from small and mid-sized media outlets and myself, that the Sheriff's Department, the Oakland County Sheriff's Department, did reinvestigate the case. In fact, Mike was able to, through court documents and court hearings, was able to get Mary Jane's body exhumed. And the investigation, this was again the 2005, 2006 timeframe, and an investigation, they performed an autopsy, another autopsy on the body, although I shouldn't say another autopsy. I don't know that they performed a very thorough autopsy back in 1948, but they performed an autopsy on the remains in 2005. And after they performed that autopsy, they gave Mike and Warren some of the remains, including the skull and a couple of bones, because they wanted the Warren Reed and Mike wanted to sort of retain that material for their own investigative purposes. And Mike hired a very well acclaimed forensic anthropologist to examine the bones with a colleague. And what they came back with was this: the skull does not belong to the rest of the skeleton that was in that coffin. And that sent quite a bit of shockwaves through this whole investigation. So that's another twist in this case. There's just a whole lot of them. But that one was one that kind of was one of those that made my eyes almost pop out of my head.
Yeah. How do you respond to that?
Yeah. Well, what I told him was, because he told me over the phone when I was talking with him, just kind of checking in with him, and he said, you know, I'll send you the forensic anthropologist's report if you want. I said, I certainly want to see that. And I did. And he sent it. He sent it to me electronically, I think, and read it right there. It was a relatively brief report, maybe three or so pages. And it essentially said that the vertebrae at the skull did not fit with the vertebrae on the spine. You know, I think it was C1 is the lower one on the skull. It didn't fit into C2, and just plain didn't fit, she said, and in the report. And then I called her, and she reiterated it, said it again, and she said, you know, it's just impossible. There's just no way that a person could walk around with this. Because I thought, well, maybe it's possible that the two would, you know, work okay, but there would be a lot of, you know, arthritis or some pain, or maybe a little bit of disfigurement in the way a person walks, maybe it's like sort of a scoliosis condition or something like that. And the forensic anthropologist said, no, you know, there's no way that someone could walk around with this kind of, with these two vertebrae. They just don't match up. So, to this day, Dave, it remains a mystery.
Why is there not an ongoing, or is there technically an ongoing investigation going on? I mean, that seems like a pretty explosive piece of evidence right there that would reopen these files and force law enforcement to start answering questions.
Right. Well, it is technically an open case. Now, when you talk to law enforcement folks, they'll say that, you know, it's an ongoing investigation, but realistically, you know, this case happened almost 70 years ago now. You know, who's around that can really shed any light on it? Not many, I can tell you that, because I tried to track down a whole bunch of them, and there's not a lot of folks around, and some of the folks who were around back then and were aware of some of the situations don't want to talk. You know, it's a very sensitive topic there, and I respect that. It's a, you know, Oregon is still a fairly conservative place, and again, I respect that. But Mike has tried several times to get an independent law enforcement agency interested in it, and just has never quite, hopped over that barrier and made it in. And I will tell you, as far as the skull and the rest of the bones go on that score, he reached out to an FBI investigator in Quantico, and this fellow was very intrigued by the case, as many people are. And said, you know, I'd be willing to help you out. I'd be willing to sort of take a look at the material you have, including the skull and the bones. And so Mike was all gassed up in his truck and had his materials, and he was setting out to drive to to Washington, D.C., and then he got an email from this FBI investigator who said, wait a minute, you broke the chain of evidence. When you took that material, the skull and the bones and what have you, away from the sort of accredited law enforcement agency, whether it was the Illinois State Police or the Ogle County Sheriff's Department, that broke the chain of evidence. And, you know, I can't, this FBI fellow said, I can't take a look at that and tell you really anything about it because we don't know the credibility of this, this material. So, and Mike was really upset about that, as you can well imagine. And he put out a $25,000 reward to find Mary Jane's skull. And of course, nobody came forward, and he maintains that, you know, if I was really messing around with evidence, the local authorities or some authorities would have charged him with that crime. He was never charged with a crime. He's been more than willing to submit those materials, the bones and the skull and the other remains that he has in his possession, to the local law enforcement authorities for them to look at it. And they've not accepted that offer. So there's that is one of those things that's just kind of swirling around, unanswered, unclear. I tried to get to the bottom of it by talking to a number of different law enforcement agencies who had some role in the exhumation, and the explanations they offer me are really they're just not satisfying. You know, they just don't completely close the loop on it.
Do you find that pretty compelling and bizarre that they're dismissing things like that, and that this crime seems to have just been swept away and under the carpet like a dirty little secret that nobody wants to find justice for?
Well, I do. I find that if I think about it a whole lot, it really does sort of deeply trouble me. And the thing that I think is most frustrating now is that the probability of solving it seems to me to be so slim now, so unlikely, that it's just a real shame.
How about the ghost of Mary Jane? Does she still make herself known?
Well, you know, not to me she does, and I don't know. I thought we would at least be on a friendly basis, but she hasn't contacted me. Maybe she's got plenty to occupy her with Mike and whoever else visits and communicates with, but she does stay in touch with Mike, from what I can tell.
This is a great story again for Halloween. Boy, you can't ask for more. Murder, mystery, unsolved crimes, and a spirit that just seems to remain restless through it all. Did you ask him why he decided to keep the skull? And I mean, that's where the level to me of morbidity starts to get a little bit, it starts to blur the lines and starts to get a little weird.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I did. And his point is he doesn't trust anybody but himself with it. In other words, he's still sort of pursuing this case and trying to get answers in it. And so he has those materials in a safe space. That he says he's keeping them because he needs to, he needs to keep them safe. He wants to make sure that that no one else can get them, and he doesn't even want to let someone, even the law enforcement agency, look at them unless he's in the room, present at all times. So he doesn't view it as kind of a. Being closer to Mary Jane or anything like that. At least I don't think he does. I think he views it strictly from the standpoint of keeping these things in a place where he knows they're safe in case they can be used for investigative purposes down the road.
Great stuff, Ted. This is a fascinating story. I thank you so much.
Thanks, Dave.
We're just covering, and I promised him that we wouldn't give away the ending on this. I mean, we certainly...
No, we can't do that.
We gave away a lot of the information here, folks. I mean, you've got the idea where they're going with this, but I do want you to read the book because this is one of those books that falls right into our lap and is a perfect connection for our listeners to read this book and follow through. I'd love to hear what you think about it. And do me a favor. When you read the book, please review it and rate it on Amazon.com so that other books like this will continue. If publishing houses see an interest in these macabre stories that have a paranormal twist, we will continue to see more of these type of books written. And as this story evolves, I would love to join you and talk again, Ted. If any new strange bits of this pop up, would you come back up and update us?
Absolutely. Would love to, Dave. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Wow. There you go. It's Halloween. You've got a ghost story. You've got unsolved crimes. You can't ask for much more except a visit with Tim and Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. Well, you know, Tim, I think that in a lot of cases, because of what we've seen on TV, drug dealers come off as bad guys. They immediately they go to their guns. They immediately want to start causing problems. And I think they're getting a bum rap, to be honest with you. Well, at least according to the first story.
What?
Yeah. According to the headline here,
okay.
Cops uncover 97 pounds of pot, nearly $1 million value, after suspect just invites them in. See, cops uncovered 97 pounds of marijuana, Tim, the devil's lettuce.
Okay. Yeah.
Satan's cabbage. Mm-hmm. Nearly $1 million in cash at an apartment in Brooklyn after being invited inside by the tenant, police said. The stash was found Friday night inside a residence at 899 Montgomery Street, according to officials. Investigators from the Jersey City Police Department had asked the NYPD to aid them in the search for an individual who was believed to be staying at that apartment, Tim, before the bus went down. That's all I'm going to say about that. When officers arrived, a different man answered the door and allowed them to come in, despite there being large amounts of pot sitting around in plain sight. It didn't take long for cops to spot the reefer, prompting them to arrest the man and the two others who were there with him. Authorities were then obtained a search warrant and discovered more cannabis throughout the entire home. All in all, they seized $931,000 in cash and 97 pounds of pot. Apartment residents Humphrey Olivo, age 36, and Yasmin Olivo, age 30, both charged with criminal possession, criminal sale, and criminal use of marijuana. Jose Picardo, who was also inside the residence at the time, was slapped with criminal use of drug paraphernalia charges, along with criminal possession and criminal sale of marijuana. The 28-year-old is listed as living in Manhattan. It's unclear if he or the Olivos know the person that Jersey City police were actually looking for. You just open the door with 97 pounds of pot and a cool million just sitting around, Tim. I mean, see that? You don't get much more cordial. Or do you think it's... The ones we see are like Tony Mantegna, and it's the cocaine and the heroin guys. Those are the ones that are a little bit more easily rattled. The weed guys are like, yeah, did you guys bring a pizza? Do you think they're
just- Yeah, their nerves are like steel. I mean, they're so calm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. Well, here you go. Here's a feel-good story for you, Tim. And we're going down to Allentown, where a Pennsylvania man stole $1 and a houseplant because he thought it was marijuana during a series of break-ins in March. He's been sentenced to up to, all right, Tim, think about this now. He stole $1 and a houseplant that was not, in fact, marijuana. How many years in jail did he get?
Well, what does a cactus go for? Let's see here. I would say years in jail. I'd probably give him maybe 1 to 2.
Right, that sounds about fair, right? You steal a buck equals 1 year. You steal a houseplant, that's another year. It could be a beloved houseplant, Tim.
Right.
No, he got 15 years in prison.
Oh!
The Morning Call reports 21-year-old Maceo Rosado Jr. was sentenced Wednesday to 7.5 to 15 years after pleading guilty in August to robbery and 3 counts of burglary. What the hell is the difference between robbery and burglary? Is one more violent? Is one, maybe you rob something. Maybe burglary is like robbing when nobody's home. Burglary is taking something from someone.
That could be.
Yeah, it could be. I could be wrong. I could be right. I could be wrong. Police say Rosado broke into Jabberjaw's Bar and Grill in Allentown. Police say the manager confronted Rosado but backed off when Rosado pointed a gun at him. Oh, now it's becoming more clear, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Rosado then made off with a keepsake dollar. Oh, my God. He took the buck from behind the bar. What a jerk. From there, police say Rosado broke into a house and left with a plant. Officers say he then threatened a woman with his gun before taking her purse. He was arrested shortly afterward. Well, now we know, right? Because he had 3 counts of burglary, 1 count of robbery. So the robbery must be just breaking into the house and stealing the plant, and the other ones, because he had the gun handy, those must have been the burglary.
Right.
I think that's the way they break it down?
I think so, yeah. Yeah. Mm.
Ooh, 7 years, and what did you walk away with? A plant and a dollar from behind the bar.
But it was a keepsake.
What a jerk. What a jerk. Hold on, since we're in the drug vein, I had a couple more drug stories here. As long as we're doing this. Oh, Tim, this would be one that breaks both of our hearts. We're staying in New Jersey, Tim.
All right.
With packages of heroin that have been coated in chocolate to disguise them as cakes.
Oh.
A man caught in New Jersey with packages of heroin coated in chocolate, disguising them as cakes, pleaded guilty to a resulting charge, prosecutors said. Acting U.S. Attorney William E. Fitzpatrick said Jacobo Leonel Orenala Estrada, age 21, a Guatemalan citizen, pleaded guilty in a Trenton federal court to 1 count of possession with intent to distribute more than 1 kilo of heroin, Tim. The smack. That smack is whack. Is heroin smack?
Oh, it's delicious, actually.
Is smack whack?
Well, if you put it in chocolate, it's got to be wonderful. Yeah.
Prosecutors said Orenella Estrada arrived at Newark Liberty International Airport from Guatemala on June 11th. Customs officers discovered what appeared to be 6 single-layer cakes in his luggage. This guy's watched too many old-time Cagney movies, sneaking the file in a cake. The officers investigated the cakes and found they were actually chocolate-covered packages of heroin, totaling nearly 7 pounds of heroin.
Oh.
Orenella Estrada faces a maximum sentence of life in prison when he is sentenced in January, Tim. That's a lot of heroin. Holy cow. Seven pounds of heroin. I mean, is that a lot of heroin? I don't know. Is that a lot of heroin?
That's a lot of heroin.
Seems like a lot of heroin to me.
Yeah.
Here we go, Tim. We talked about the robbery that garnered a dollar and a houseplant that he believed was marijuana but was in fact not. Here's a kind of a reversal of fortune story. And I know you like a good old-fashioned reversal of fortune, karma shines on you story, and we've got one.
Yeah.
A Nintendo 64 was left behind after the tires were slashed and cars were ransacked in Shaler Township. The thief of thieves left a trail of surprising items behind in the cars that they ransacked. A dozen cars were ransacked and another had its tires slashed Monday night, according to Shaler Township police. Police said they could not connect the slashing to the attempted thefts, but noted that it all happened in the northwest section of township. I don't know why I started to sound like Andy Rooney there, Tim. It all happened. Well, that was more Barney Fife. I don't know where I'm going with this. Things were rifled all over the place, Donna Stoltz said. She found her Toyota Highlander disheveled Tuesday morning. Maybe the Toyota Highlander had been out drinking the night before, Tim.
Maybe.
But she said nothing was missing. She admitted to leaving the doors unlocked. It's sad. I'm sorry. I really trust people around here, but you just never know, Stoltz said. The thief or thieves left some items behind in a car they ransacked on the 800 block of Pickwood Drive. The car's owner found a water bottle, Gatorade bottle, and a Nintendo 64 video game system inside the ransacked car. So this guy's kind of like Robin Hood. He stole from others to leave behind So I know you're gonna wanna you're gonna get thirsty playing Nintendo, man. What Nintendo 64? That's got to be like 20 years old now, right?
That's pretty old, yeah.
Are those worth anything at this point?
You know, the older systems are making a comeback, so eventually it'll be worth something, sure.
Yeah, I don't call it a comeback, Tim. It's been there for years.
Yeah.
None of those three items belonged to the car's owner. She believed the thief left those things inside. I'm going to guess, before we get to the end of the story, that that means there might have been drugs involved. The owner of a different ransacked car said cigarette ashes were left all over the front seats. We've got two kids, so if they wanted to take diapers, they could have, but they didn't do anything like that, Jeff Koski said. Lieutenant David Benko said Shaler Township Police are investigating the crimes. So far, no arrests have been reported. So you break into a couple cars, smoke a couple of heaters in the front seat, flick your ashes all over, break into another car, and leave a Nintendo 64, a Gatorade, and a water bottle. It's a gift that keeps on giving, Tim.
Yeah, I'll say it is.
Yeah, let me see here. Here we go, Tim. Florida's back on our charts. Police in Florida said they arrested an armed robber who attempted to conceal his identity with an unusual disguise. What did he wear, Tim? What was this thief's unusual disguise?
Halloween costume?
Well, that'd be easy to guess, sure. But, I mean, can we be specific? What do you think he was wearing as a Halloween costume?
A ballerina costume?
Nope. A simple scuba mask, Tim. The Largo Police Department said officers responded at about 1:22 a.m. Tuesday to a Speedway gas station in Largo where the silent alarm had been triggered. Officers arrived to a witness suspect, later identified as Jeffrey Chad Davis. First of all, does that say, and it's spelled the fancy way, Tim, G-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y. Do you think was just a hazing from one of the local establishments? Okay, Jeffrey, you're going to have to go hold up one of those atrocious gas stations whilst wearing a scuba mask. Oh, he's 31. Oh, I guess that takes him out of the old, college, what do they call those dorms?
Fraternity?
Yeah, fraternities.
Yep.
He committed the robbery inside the convenience store while armed with a knife, Tim.
A knife?
Yeah. Well, what else? I mean, if you're going in a scuba Steve, you should at least have your trusty knife and your scuba mask, right? Davis's face was disguised with a scuba mask, police said. Police surrounded the store. And a security video shared by the department on Facebook shows a suspect exit the store with a cart full of merchandise about an hour after the robbery began. What, was this guy swimming in slow motion? How long does it take for a robbery? Officers moved in on Davis once he was a short distance from the door, and they tackled him with the help of a canine unit as he attempted to run back into the business. Two employees inside the Speedway were unharmed, police said. Davis was arrested on charges of armed robbery while resisting an officer without violence. He was ordered held in lieu of a $155,000 bond. So, now, if I were an attorney, Tim, if I were a defense attorney, do you know what my defense would be?
First of all, I don't know.
I'd go to the tapes and listen, because it's got to sound a lot like this. This is a sucker. Please give me all your cigarettes. I'll take some Tic Tacs and some of those condoms. And I'll take a Hoover's magazine. So, right there, he could have just been, you know, he could have just been asking politely for these things. These guys overreact because he's wearing a scuba mask and has a knife in his hand. So they automatically assume it's a robbery gone horribly wrong. And this poor guy is just trying to exit out the back door with all of this stuff that people just handed to him.
I see where you're going.
You see, yeah. I think there's a defense here, because have you ever talked to somebody with a scuba mask on and they're snorkel, Tim? It's all ugly. And I don't think that they're going to get out the door with anything.
No.
Scuba mask might not have been the best choice. An hour to rob a place. Man, you've got to be slow moving at the age of 31. Jeffrey was taking his sweet-ass time, Tim.
Oh. It takes all kinds, I guess, Dave. It does. Maybe you didn't have a... Where are you going to find a ski mask in Florida? I mean, think about
it. Right, I guess scuba's the way you got to go. Well, yeah. You said it. You hit the nail on the head, Tim. It takes all kinds. And this next story proves that. A California mom stuffed her own baby into a duffel bag to kidnap the newborn from the hospital. So I'm confused by that to begin with. First of all, I'm a father. I've got 8 kids, Tim. And I've been able to take each one home with me all by myself. I haven't had to sneak one out in a duffel bag yet.
Yeah, you don't have to win a prize or anything in order to take them home. Yeah.
A California woman faces child endangerment charges after she allegedly stuffed her newborn into a duffel bag and kidnapped the baby from the hospital, according to the Merced Sun-Star. Police say 35-year-old Stephanie Belden didn't want her newborn baby to be taken away after testing positive for meth during childbirth on August 17th. Police met with her 3 hours prior to let her know the child was going to be detained. The biological mother wasn't very happy with that, went back up, made her way into the maternity ward, and cut off the alarm bracelet off the newborn baby, put the newborn baby in a duffel bag, and walked out of the hospital, Fresno Police Lieutenant Jay Struble told KFSN. A nurse noticed the child was missing around 7:30 p.m., and officers were called at 7:36 p.m. Belden was arrested at 7:58 p.m. after police found her hiding at her house. She's charged with kidnapping, child stealing, child endangerment, and a parole violation. Isn't that a little overkill, kidnapping and child stealing? First of all, is it really stealing if it's your child? Kidnapping, maybe, because you took the child without the permission of the authorities who said that they were going to detain the baby.
Right.
No, that just seems weird. Not that I'm standing up for this woman, Tim. She's obviously not right. But what's scarier to me is she was able to go in, cut the alarm bracelet off, put the baby in a duffel bag, and leave, and nobody knew for quite a while.
Yeah.
That's scary. I thought they've beaten that system.
Yeah.
I don't know. I could be wrong. Oh, well, here we go. Another mother. This one's another Mother of the Year award. Pop probability, Tim. We're going to go to Long Island for this story, where a woman was busted Saturday after robbing a bank while her young daughter waited in the getaway car, police said. Diana Marini passed a note demanding cash to a teller inside a Chase Bank branch on Veterans Memorial Highway in Islandia, Long Island, around 1 p.m. The 28-year-old woman grabbed an undisclosed amount of cash, ran out of the bank, and got into a waiting taxi, according to police. Responding cops found the cab nearby with Marini and her 6-year-old daughter inside. The Brentwood woman was charged with robbery and endangering the welfare of a child. Her daughter was released to family members, and Marini was expected to be arraigned on Saturday. That takes some balls, holding a place up using a cab as your getaway vehicle.
Yeah, it does.
Let's see here. Okay, we're gonna round this out with three of probably the dumbest stories we've got this week.
All right.
A man who found himself locked overnight inside a Wisconsin store's beer cooler was cited for theft when he helped himself to some beverages. Police said Jeremy Van Ert, age 38, told officers he was shopping at the Quick Trip store Tuesday night in Marshfield and ended up trapped in the store's cooler when employees locked it for the night at 11:50. A Quick Trip manager said a customer told employees at about 5:50 a.m. Wednesday that there appeared to be a man locked in the cooler, and he left the store in a hurry when employees opened the door. The manager said the man had an 18-ounce bottle of Ice House beer and 3 cans of malt beverage, 4 Loco, while locked in the cooler, and had knocked over a stack of boxes, destroying 3 more cans of beer. The man was cited for retail theft for not paying for the beverages when he left the store. Police said Van Ert was arrested on probation, held from an unrelated case. Police said the conditions of Van Ert's probation banned him from consuming alcohol. All right, so I understand that aspect of the arrangement, but I think you kind of owe a guy. If you accidentally lock him in for the night and he's locked in your cooler, I think you got to kick him a couple cans of beer and not whine too much about it.
But did he set it up so he would be locked in the cooler?
Tim, you're such a cynic. How dare you, sir? Who the hell would put themselves in a cooler on purpose?
A guy who's not able to drink by order of a court?
Well, there's that. We're going to Port Richey, Florida for our next story, Tim. WFLA reports that a 54-year-old Florida woman was arrested Sunday after she was caught stealing cement pavers from a home in Port Richey. Deputies arrested Julianne Upright after 5 p.m. on Woodbridge Court when he found 42 cement decorative blocks worth $420 in her vehicle. The homeowner told detectives that he caught her taking the blocks without permission. They were part of a remodeling project and were stored in the front yard about 4 feet from the roadway, the owner said. Upright said she thought they were just trash. Deputy said she then threatened to sue the owner because she hurt her back on his property while loading the stolen blocks into her vehicle. To make matters worse, the deputy said the blocks were stolen within a county that was subject to a state of emergency declared by the governor under Chapter 252. Upright was taken to the Lando Lakes Detention Center. Going to sue, Tim, because she hurt her back stealing something from your yard. What's scary is I wonder if she has a case.
They should have had a weight belt around for her.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. Yeah, you got to be careful in case you have those thieves that come cruising through. All right, Tim, we're going to wrap up our day of jocularity and stupidity back in Florida where we love to be, Tim.
Aw.
We're going to Seminole County, Florida, thanks to WFTV Channel 9 ABC News. A man was taken into custody early Monday morning after he barricaded himself inside his Seminole County home for more than 5 hours, deputies said. Dozens of law enforcement officers arrived at the home on Cecilia Avenue in Apopka near Bear Lake at about 9:30 p.m. after receiving a call about a family disturbance. The man's wife, her daughter, and a child fled the home after the man fired several rounds from a handgun, detective said. He then barricaded himself inside and would not surrender to the law enforcement. That's what deputies are reporting. Deputies said the man was inside a room singing. Neighbors were told to stay inside their home. The man, whose name was not released, is undergoing a mental evaluation, Tim. The man was taken to jail but has not completed the booking process. Authorities said he could be charged with domestic violence and aggravated assault with a deadly weapon without intent to kill. No one, thankfully, was injured. So this guy arms himself in and then dances and sings until he decides to finally give himself up. Maybe it was his way. He frustrated American Idol contestant, never gets any showtime, couldn't get on The Voice, Tim. Even America's Next Top Model wanted nothing to do with this cat. So he's like, somebody's going to pay attention to me.
Well, that's a good
fire off a few rounds, get the attention. There are going to be cameras now because I fired my gun, and I'm going to let loose, right?
Uh-huh.
We've got some audio from that right now, Tim. Yeah, I can see why he didn't make it on America's Got Talent. Tim, there's not much talent there.
No. It's two cats having relations in the back alley probably sound better.
Yeah. No, that's terrifying. Have you ever heard that, Tim? Have you ever heard cats?
Yeah.
Doing the wild polka boogie.
Yeah.
What? That's no, Tim. It's horrific. I thought a baby was being eaten by a wolf outside my window when I heard it. I woke up. My girlfriend and I woke up when we lived in Illinois to this sound. Tim, put me in a room with demons. Put me in a room with werewolves. Put me in a room with serial killers that turn into demons and werewolves. That would be less scary than the sound I heard coming from outside my window. It was horrific. Seriously, it sounded like a baby being eaten alive. It was horrible. Wait, I got to read this story. This headline just popped up. Woman accused of stabbing an off-duty deputy after setting her boyfriend's house ablaze. Edgewater, Florida. Oh, there's a surprise. A woman accused of stabbing an off-duty Volusia County deputy who intervened in a fight between her and her boyfriend after she set his house on fire faced a judge Sunday. Brittany Bonin, I'll just leave it there, was denied bail and faces charges of assault, battery, and arson. The judge placed Bonin on suicide watch and ordered a mental health evaluation. Bonin and her boyfriend got into a fight at the house on the 3300 block of Pine Tree Drive. Officer said Bonin ran into a nearby home of Captain Cliff Williams, who was an off-duty police officer. Oh, that's bad timing. Oh, that's just like the worst. If you're going to run into a place, that's like the one place you don't want to run into is an off-duty cop's house, right?
Right.
She ran in to seek assistance. Bonin then followed the man to the deputy's home and tried to attack him. Wait, this does make... Bonin and her friend got in a fight. Bonin ran to the nearby home to get help. They must have made a mistake here. Bonin followed the man. Okay, so the man ran to Captain Cliff Williams' house. Bonin followed the man into the deputy's home and tried to attack him, but not before setting the man's house on fire. Well, she was, you know what? She was convicted to what she needed to do, Tim. She knew she had a plan she had to follow through. She didn't deviate from said plan. She just, she made her move, and that was it. You gotta at least give it to her. She had a goal she set forth to complete. Not many people in today's society do that, Tim. They get halfway in and they just bail.
That's right.
But not this girl. She was willing to stay in. Bonin followed the man to the deputy's house, not before setting the man's house on fire. Williams, a 25-year-old veteran of VCSO and a former Marine, tried to shield the man from Bonin's attack, but was stabbed in the process. It just goes to show you, you're never truly off duty, said Sheriff Mike Chitwood. He took a knife wound that was meant for someone else because his instinct was to step in as a protector. Now, while Bonin faced a judge, her boyfriend's family cleaned up the mess police said she left behind. A lot of damage in here from the fish tanks. It's 90 gallons of water total, said Jacqueline Damala, the man's sister. Williams was taken to Florida Hospital in New Smyrna Beach with injuries that are not life-threatening, police said. Edgewater Fire and Rescue was able to extinguish the home. That's crazy. You know, anytime you think you've had a bad relationship, Tim, just remember, at least you're not that guy.
That's true.
You're not going to end up with a Bonin.
What?
Yeah, with Miss Bonin. You're not going to end up with that. You, no matter how bad things seem, Tim.
All right.
Bonin could be worse.
What?
Yeah, that's true. Well, that's it for today, kids. We hope that you have a very safe and happy Halloween. We want to thank you very much for tuning in to be a part of our show. And remember to check out our Beyond the Darkness True Crime Tuesday Revisited. We went back into the annals of our history to find a good Halloween-themed episode. And I think we've got one, Tim.
Right? Oh, yes.
You got a serial killer and a werewolf in a game of wicked love, and you've got to check it out. It's Beyond the Darkness. It is a True Crime Tuesday Revisited case, and it is Canada's, at the time, youngest serial killer and her 300-year-old werewolf boyfriend. It's everything you could possibly want in a case, so go listen to that. Check it out for yourself. Thank you guys for being a part of our show and being a part of our world. We'll be back tomorrow with the kickoff of a whole new month. As November 1st rolls around, we'll see you guys next Tuesday. And Tim, when we go next Tuesday, since November is kind of the month of family and Thanksgiving, we're going to take a little visit down into one of the weirdest families, Tim. We're going to talk to a survivor, Diana Lake, from the Manson family.
Wow.
What was it like to be a part of the Manson family at their heyday and during the crime of the century? We'll find out about that next week here on the Best in True Crime Talk Radio. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader, and this is True Crime Tuesday.